All right, so this is going to be a six-week series where we're going to explore the concept of Musar, what is Musar, and how we can make it practical in our own lives. So we're going to start with the definition of Musar, but first I want to just look at the 6 weeks and what we're going to do. So I have it on the sheet here, and I wrote out just an introductory paragraph, which I guess I'll read since not everybody kind of has a feeling for what we're doing. So, while many want to grow in a meaningful way and are willing to work hard to accomplish true progress, few understand how to approach that growth and what the goals and fruits of such work might be. Musar is the Torah's path to real growth and lasting accomplishment. But how can we access the wisdom of the Musar giants in a way that's meaningful to us in our times and circumstances? Bridging the Gap by Avi Fertig, the book that we're going to be using, provides an in-depth analysis of Musar principles as well as highly accessible roadmap for their application in today's world. The series will offer a taste of part one of the book, introducing concepts from the first seven chapters. So week one this week, we'll talk about the definition of Musar and the science of Musar. Week two, on the bottom of the page, simple, not simplistic. Week three, Hispuninus and Hispalus. Week four, change through Musar. Week five, the tension of greatness. And week six, balance and greatness. So let's just start, I think, right from the top. What is Musar? So what have you heard?
Ethics.
Behavior. Anybody else? In a way, Musar today is kind of like the new Kabbalah. And I'm saying Kabbalah, not Kabbalah, because it's becoming kind of not quite all the rage, and it's certainly not Hollywood rage, but Musar is a new thing that people are studying, often outside of the context of Judaism, like the Kabbalah Center studies Kabbalah outside the context of Judaism. So you might say this is the Torah's prescription for character development. That's one way to define it. Torah's prescription for character development. But let's just see if we can get a little bit further in an understanding of what it actually is. So the word Musar comes from the same root as Yisurin, which means suffering. So it's something that we Jews happen to be good at, or at least have experienced quite a bit of. So how does this pertain to what we're going to be learning? What is suffering? And so we'll look at suffering a little bit later, but how is that the root? If you ask any yeshiva guy about Musar, he'll shudder. Not interested, and most are not interested at all. Keep Musar far away from me is how most yeshiva guys feel, because the way that it's currently used in the vernacular is rebuke. You know, I was walking through the halls with my shirt untucked, and boy, did my Rebbe give me Musar about that. That's the way it's used in the hallways of, let's say, Toras Chaim. However, it's also used as a Musar shmooze. So Rabbi Feldheim gives the Musar shmooze, I think, on Wednesday nights. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is the father of the Musar movement. Rabbi Dessler, who wrote Strive for Truth, used to give the Musar shmooze in the yeshivas in the last, I guess, two generations ago. So the Musar shmooze was the exhortation, the sometimes fire and brimstone sermon. So it is, in the yeshiva world, related to fire and brimstone, but that's not what it means either. But that is a flavor that's there. That's not what we're going to be doing at all. So what is Musar? So from the book, let's see, we just covered the first page. From the book, The Science of Musar, okay, so if we look on The Science of Musar, it talks about using these two words, architecture and engineering. And I really want to bring you through the book without necessarily reading it inside. You can read it if you want to, but I want you to be able to take notes in it if you want to. So really we're looking at the second page where it says The Science of Musar. It uses the terms architecture and engineering. Here, the pages are right here. So a building can't be built without both architecture, the science of architecture, and the science of engineering. The architect designs the building, draws it on a piece of paper, but that's not the building, right? The engineer knows how to make things spring up from the ground, knows how to take a pile of bricks and concrete and wood and make it all into a building, but needs direction or a vision for that to happen. You can't, without both, you don't have a building. So if we think of Torah as the architecture, Musar is engineering. Musar is how Torah builds us. Torah is flat on the page. Torah is meant to transform us. We're meant to grow through Torah. We're meant to become different. That's really the whole purpose of the whole system of Torah and mitzvahs, is how will we be changed through this? The whole point of a mitzvah is to transform us. Let's move back for just a minute and define mitzvah, which I've done in several classes. So hopefully some of you have heard it. I don't know if anybody can repeat it, but let's just put throw out there, if you know my definition, great. If not, just tell me, what does mitzvah mean?
Commandment.
Commandment, good. Anybody else?
613 of them.
There's 613 of them.
Some of which we know the rational reason for, others we do not.
That is true. Well, what is it actually? So commandment, let's look, think about the word itself, the actual word.
Command.
Anything else?
Guidelines for action.
Okay, guidelines for action, good.
Posits a commander.
It does posit a commander. The root, we have pages up here if you want to come take one of each. Okay. The root of the word mitzvah, the Talmud says, shares the root with the word for pliers. And we can learn something from that. It definitely means commandment. We are commanded to do these things. But it also shares the same root. This is page one, and then there's six here. Also same, serves the same, shares the same root as pliers. The function of a pliers is to connect disparate ends. So the function of a mitzvah is to connect disparate ends. We are commanded to do it, but its function is to connect disparate ends. What are those disparate ends? It's physical and spiritual, us and God. That's really the two disparate ends. Really, the question is, if we're spiritual beings having this physical experience, so, and we're a soul before we're born and we're a soul after we die, so why are we spiritual beings having this physical experience? What's the point of wearing a body on our soul for all this time? And the answer really is, I'm not going to make you go through this whole process since today our focus is this. The answer really is, why wear a body? To transform our soul. We want to be able to leave the world differently than how we entered it. And the only way we can exit different than the way we entered is by using the tool that we're given in this world, and that's our body. So we're given this body that we wear, and then the whole world as an arena of operation to behave in. And how we use this body with what's around us is how our soul is affected. So that hopefully we'll exit differently than how we entered. That's really who we are, is the distance between how we enter and how we exit. So if we exit the same as how we entered, we achieve nothing, we're really then nothing. So really we want to accomplish something in our time here. So how do we accomplish that? What should we accomplish? So that's where the Torah comes in. The Torah says there's 613 pathways of accomplishment plus all the fine print. Really, 613 doesn't apply to any one person. There's mitzvahs only for Kohanim, only for Levim, only for Yisraels, only for men, only for women. It's only as a collective whole that we can actually accomplish 613. And then there's many rabbinic commandments as well. So bless you. There's 613 biblical commandments and a myriad of rabbinic commandments as well. Each one of those, the job is to connect us, to use our physical to create a spiritual goal. That's what it is. So in order to use our body and use this world to make a difference spiritually, we do a mitzvah. Now, in order to do all that, we have to learn. But really, the whole point is transformation. So the Torah is the architecture of transformation. Mussar is the science of transformation. It's engineering. How do you actually make it happen? You could put on tefillin every day and it won't transform you unless you know what you're trying to do. You could learn Torah every day. We've all met people who learn and aren't nice people. They haven't been transformed by it, right? Or we meet people who are kind that didn't learn because that's how they came into the world. They're just kind people, right? So, but we want to figure out, how can we take who we are, our raw material, use the Torah to maximize our time here and become as amazing as we possibly can be, really to achieve greatness. And we're not going to achieve greatness unless we make it a goal. So we all have to say, who do I want to be? I want to be the most amazing, fabulous me that I possibly can be. That's my goal. I don't want to just schlep through life and just put out little fires and sometimes big fires and then kind of try to build something along the way. What? What's your goal? You're not going to make it if you don't have a goal. So you need a destination. The destination is greatness, and it's within all of our reach, but it's a lot of work. So how do we do the work? That's what Mussar is about. So that's what we're going to be learning. Mussar is the science of how do we make it happen. How do we allow the Torah that we learn to transform us? How do we take what Mordechai Mishori, I don't even know what he spoke about, but I know him. So how do we make that sink into us so that we're changed by it? So that's what we're going to look at. So that's really the science of Musar. Let me check our pages here and make sure. Okay. All right, so if we can reach that, and that's what the science of Musar has had to reach it, then the process must therefore be inherently individualistic. And that's very important. A lot of times we feel like Torah teaches us to all kind of be the same, or all kind of sheep in a flock. That's not it at all. The science of Musar has to be, it has to be, by definition, an individual path. It's a pathway, not a destination. The destination is to me or to you. Nobody can be what you can be. There is no possibility that anybody could accomplish what you can accomplish in your life, because nobody has your parents, your abilities, your disabilities, your socioeconomic bracket, born into your century, into your neighborhood, with your background, your baggage, your stuff, your ability, all of that never converged in a person like it did in you, ever, and it never will. So only you can achieve it, and so therefore your pathway has to be a completely individual pathway to reach the goal of you, who you are, or who you could be, or who you want to be. Okay, so what's the big problem then? We have our first major hurdle, and that is these words here. We're going to get a lot of vocabulary words today. So the first major hurdle is tuma. Does anybody have a definition for tuma? Excellent. Spiritual contamination. That's good. Anybody else? So we do talk about tuma and tahara. We don't have those words in English, so they can't be translated properly in English. So we fumble around for a way to explain those concepts. So inadequately, we've translated them as clean and unclean, or pure and impure, or contaminated and pure, or better, spiritually contaminated and spiritually pure, but still none of those really capture what it is. So really, anything that's tahor, which is the, let's see, tahor is the adjective and tahara is the noun, anything that's tahor, which is the opposite of what we're talking about now, tuma, anything that's tahor has to do with potential, life, and growth. Anything that's tamei, that has tuma, has to do with death, end of potential, stoppage of ability. That's what really death is, the end of your ability to move forward, right? And life is constant potential. As long as you're alive, you still can accomplish something. Once you're dead, it's done. So tuma has to do with death. Tahara has to do with life. So that being said, there's a spectrum. So the most tame thing is a dead Jewish body. And the least tame thing is like dead skin cells. Somewhere in the middle is dead animals, dead non-kosher animals, roadkill, things like that, stepping on a mouse, a dead bug, scratching your head, touching your shoe, menstruation, other things that have to do with a death energy or the exit of life potential. And then there's tahor. Things that are tahor are things that have to do with life potential. And there's also a list, a continuum of that. It's harder to speak about, but the more potential something brings, the more tahor it is, and the less, then it can be on a spectrum as well. It's easier to see a spectrum of tuma than it is to see a spectrum of tahara, but there's a spectrum of both. Tuma is so then a way to translate it might be blockage of spiritual potential. So that we can live a life, tuma then is related to this word timtum. Really, it's interesting. Timtum halev, so we're going to talk about this blockage of the heart. A timtum, technically in Hebrew, is somebody whose genitals are covered, so you can't tell if they're male or female. That's a timtum. So that they're, I don't mean covered in clothing, I mean covered so a doctor can't tell, right? What is this? Is this a male or is this a female? When that question arises, when you check and can't tell, that person is called a timtum. So, but the word really comes from covered, where you can't tell. So timtumalev, the root, is the same root as tuma. Timtumalev is a covering of the heart, a blockage of the heart. So how does that happen to us? How do we get a blockage of the heart? It has to do with how we behave. Everything has to do with how we behave. We behave ourselves into different places, behave ourselves into greater understanding, behave ourselves into lesser understanding, behave ourselves into better relationships, behave ourselves into more distant relationships. But each behavior that we do, just think about a friendship. The more you call, the more you send a card, the more you drop by, the stronger the friendship becomes. You behave yourself into a much stronger friendship. The more you forget about them, the more you forgot their birthday, the more you didn't call, the more you didn't stop by, the more on your Shabbos walk you passed their house, the more you behave yourself into a more distant friendship. Right? So, and the same thing with our relationship with God, with our relationship with our spouse, with our relationship with learning, with our relationship with self. We can behave our ways into different realities. So most of us behave our ways into Timtum Halev because we lead life in a way of life leading. We just kind of go on. It's interesting. I learned this week, for those of you who say the morning blessings, yeah, I'll keep an eye on the time. For those of you who say the morning blessings, there's a conundrum in the morning blessings. The first one that we say is, thank you, God, for giving the rooster wisdom to discern between day and night. So that's kind of a strange blessing, but we say that the rooster is really a parable for the heart, and we thank God for giving us the wisdom to discern between good and bad. But then, all the way down the list, right at the very end, it says, thank you, God, for taking sleep away from my eyes, after we've already said all the other ones. So you'd think, first you should say, thank you for taking sleep away from my eyes, and then after you got dressed and did all the things, said all the blessings when you put on your shoes, and when you put on, took your first step, when you stood up out of bed, and when you put on your belt, and today we just say them in a row. We don't say them when we do each thing, but they are all connected with a behavior. But you think, first you wake up, and then after you've like gotten yourself dressed and you've gone through all the other blessings, then you say, thank you for helping my heart understand. First I wake up and then I understand. Not first I understand and then I wake up. Right? Especially after you've done all that stuff. So Rav Shimon Schwab says the reason why that we say thank you for waking me up is because all of humanity is asleep, really. If you look back in the creation story of Eve, so how is Eve created? Adam was put into a deep sleep. And then God took the rib out and made Eve. And then Adam says, oh, this is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Great, let's get married. But it never says he woke him up. So he's functioning still in that anesthetized state. So, and we're all descendants from Adam and Eve. So all of humanity is still functioning in an anesthetized state. And so we kind of plod through the world not fully aware of everything and the import of everything that we do and the impact of our actions, just kind of moving. But the Jews have had the opportunity to have some wakeful moments. Not that we're awake all the time, but we've had wake-up moments. So from Abraham's first wake-up moment where he connected with God to, so that was in our history, but as a nation, going into Egypt, being taken out of Egypt, standing at Mount Sinai, and then a few other, splitting of the Red Sea, Reed Sea, and a few other wake-up moments in history where we've, and in our own lives, we have moments of clarity, like a bolt of lightning that comes, you see everything, and then it goes. But you have a moment of awakening. So the Jewish people have had moments of awakening, and because of that, we're elected to be the leaders of all humanity. All humanity's destiny is to be great. Each one of us can choose that. Each one of us can be in an amazing relationship with God. It's just that the Jews lead the way. We're supposed to be teaching it. So we're supposed to be teaching it by how we do it. So first we have to figure out how to do it for ourselves. Okay, so, but we live this life of Timtum Halev because of how we behave. We don't really notice most of what's going on. So, and that leads to kind of the next thing on the line, to an intellectual and spiritual split. Like, I know it's important. I wash every day on bread. I bench. As long as I remember, sometimes I get distracted, get up and forget. But in general, I wash before I have bread. I bench after I eat it. I say my prayers before I eat food. I say them after. I say my prayers after I come out of the bathroom. I dress in a particular way that's Jewish, but I don't even think about that anymore. The only time I really think about how I dress now is when I shop, because everything that's in my closet works in terms of how I choose to dress, right? So I think about it when I shop, oh, this sleeves are too short, or this can be put over something, or this neck has to be higher. But I don't, like, think every single time I get dressed, I'm dressing in order to represent myself as a soul and not a body. I want to dress in a way that removes distractions from my soul and focuses all the attention on my soul and away from my body in a way that's attractive and yet not attracting, right? I don't think that every single time I get dressed. And yet, that is the thought behind how I dress. So it means I'm just walking through life in a kind of regular way, right? So I know it's important in my brain, but my heart doesn't always get it on a daily basis. And that's what hergel is, this next word, hergel. And we have, that's part of the book in here, hergel. So hergel comes from the word foot, regel. And actually, it's interesting, in English, when something gets regular, it has the root regel in it, right? Because it's regular. It's the way that it just is what we do. It's become regular, and that's hergel, or regular, is inside that word. So getting used to something, it just becoming rote, routine, that's the way we do it. So when we fall into patterns of regularness, that's when we risk that spiritual and intellectual split, where we know in our brains, but we don't know it in our hearts, really. We're not living it in a daily breath-by-breath existence, which isn't really how we can live. And we can't live every single moment feeling every single drop of every single spiritual reality that's there. But we can live in a way in which we are growing on a regular basis spiritually. So that brings us up to, so hergel being our next main block, or really the cause of Timtum Halev. It's interesting. Okay, so here's, I want to make sure that I put this in the right place here. So it does have a story in here. I'll just read this story. Okay, so one Purim, as the students of the famed Volozhin Yeshiva sat with their Rosh Yeshiva, then Netziv, a student asked him the following, Rebbe, we all know that everyone who travels through Volozhin is impressed with the glory of Torah represented by the Yeshiva. Why then do the local townsfolk who see this glory on a daily basis remain unaffected? Why do most remain ignoramuses, lacking all sensitivity of Kedusha? And so sometimes we don't see the diamond in our midst. And the Netziv said, it's precisely because they're constantly exposed to the greatness and glory of Torah that they remain unaffected. It's because they constantly hear the sounds of Torah emanating from the Beis HaMidrash that they're numb to it. This is the power of Hergel. It is constantly with us, and we must constantly struggle against it. The only effective weapon is Musar. So when it becomes regular, that's when we don't pay attention. So now suffering and Musar. So suffering serves many different functions in Judaism, where Jewish philosophy talks about several different functions for suffering. One of them is for a kapara, for atonement, to actually help a person move out of a space in which they've done something negative. That negative behavior needs to be expiated, actually, from their very soul. So suffering can help with that. It is an agent that removes negativity from one's soul. It should, hopefully, move one to tshuva. When we experience something negative, we can't know what we did and should never judge ourselves harshly, but we should always ask the question. So I'll give you, for instance, of what I mean. Let's say somebody gets a cold sore, right? It's class pictures, right, or company pictures, and that day you wake up with a cold sore, and you look terrible, right? So you shouldn't say, I have this cold sore because I spoke Lashon Hara. But you should say, I wonder why I have this cold sore. Perhaps I could work on my Lashon Hara, right? So we can't necessarily say it's definitely what it is, right? Whether it's financial tsuris or some kind of disfiguring, whatever it is, on the scale that can be, or marital problems, or child-rearing problems, or loneliness, or illness, or whatever it is. There's so many different ways to suffer. So we should use suffering to look at ourselves and say, how could I grow through this? What might this be pointing me in the direction to? But we should never say, it's for sure that, because we can't know. And if we ever do that to ourselves, we're judging ourselves too harshly, and we'll come to possibly judge others, which we should never, ever do. So we never, when we see somebody else's cold sore, say, I bet you are speaking Lashon Hara. And that's totally out of bounds, completely. So we never say that. If a good friend says, I don't know why I'm having tsuris after tsuris after tsuris, and they came to you to ask, then you could help them reflect and think, is there anything that you could work on? But it doesn't mean that if you work on it, it's going to be taken care of. That's why we never, ever associate, really. Just ask the question. But the other thing that it should do is help move us spiritually. So it can expiate, but it is supposed to push us into introspection, push us into growth, push us into movement. And for this, I do want to read straight from the Ramchal. He quotes for the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. Okay, so two different things. Roots of suffering in this world. So that's on suffering and Musar. Heaven may visit an individual with suffering as an impetus to repentance, to cause him to examine his deeds. Such suffering, however, is not the same as discussed earlier, which served as atonement for sin. Rather, these sufferings are meant to arouse the person's heart and motivate him to repent. So there's two different types. One is for atonement, and one is for movement. If you want to get out of the suffering that's meant for movement, Musar is the pathway, because Musar is a movement pathway. So Musar is proactive movement, and suffering is pushing movement. So if you need to move in your life, you can either choose to move or get pushed. It's up to us, really, what we want to do. That doesn't take care of the atonement suffering, but it does take care of the movement suffering. So that's why suffering and Musar have the same root. Remember we said that Musar has the root of Yisurim, suffering. But it's really a way to bypass the suffering by going proactively into growth rather than having to get a zetz to go into growth.
But our commandments are forced upon us.
Interesting. Interesting. You want to elaborate a little bit?
Well, can you say that again? They're pushed upon us, and if we're to be proactive, well, then why are we pushed? Why are we required?
Okay, so you're saying that commandment altogether is something that we don't have a choice about. We're pushed into, we're forced to keep the commandments, right?
By the definition
of commandment, right? Right. So it's true that today in this room, none of us woke up one day. Well, some of us did, but few of us woke up and said, I want these commandments. I'm going to take them all on, right? But our souls all did at Mount Sinai. So it was a choice at some point. And because of this Timtum Alev, we're sometimes not in touch with the fact that we chose into it. But the Jews did say, Na'aseh v'nishma, I will do and I will hear. So we did say as a group, collectively, all of us said, I want this. It's interesting because I'm sure you're all aware of that midrash where God is offering the Torah to the world. So he first goes to other nations. So he goes to the Ishmaelites. I don't remember all the nations, but he says to the Ishmaelites, do you want the Torah? And they say, what's in it? God says, no killing. They say, forget about it. It's not for us. Right? He goes to Esav, the Edomites, I think. Are they the same ones? Edom, Esav. And he says, do you want the Torah? And they say, what's in it? And he says, no stealing. And they say, forget about it. Goes to another nation, and says, what's in it? And he says, no idol worship. And they say, forget about it. Goes to the Jews, says, do you want it? And the Jews say, we'll take it. Na'aseh v'nishma. So we will do and we will hear. That's how we say it. It's like when a good friend asks you for a favor. What do you say? Can you do me a favor? What's your answer? Of course. What is it? Not, what is it? I'll think about it, right? Of course. What is it? I'll do it. Now tell me what it is. When a good friend asks you, you trust them and you say, of course. Now tell me what it is. That's what we said to Hashem. I'll do it. Now tell me what it is. Right? So we all said that. Now in that midrash, there's all those nations, right? Who answered? Did the whole nation of the Ishmaelites see God and see the Torah and everybody said, no, we don't want it? Who answered? So we know that we're the only nation that experienced national revelation. So it couldn't be that everyone in the nation heard it or saw God or saw the Torah. So we know it's the energy of the nation or the angel of that nation that made the answer. The collective energetic presence of that nation answered. However, there were individuals in each nation that wanted it. And that's one source of converts today, where those individuals in those outlying nations that say, wait a second, oh, but I want it. But they were part of that nation. It wasn't the time or whatever it was. There wasn't a way to get in yet. But their reincarnations are able to accept it. So are we accepting it voluntarily? We are commanded in the end. But it's only after we said, yes, we'll take the commandments. We agreed 100%. We want to be in this relationship with God, with you, God. Now tell us how to do the relationship. Oh, here's 613 ways to do this relationship. So they're not forced upon us, but it sometimes feels like it.
Well, it is kind of like, one of the questions, I guess, is like it's the offer you can't refuse. There's a mountain hanging over our head, right?
Right, so the mountain is really for the oral law.
Okay.
Because, I mean, even though there's the joke, you know, unfortunately, there's this joke, so when God says to the Jews, do you want the Torah? The Jews said, sure, we'll take two, right? So that's the joke, but, right? But actually we didn't. We said, we just want the one. And God said, well, they go together. It's a pair. And the Jews said, well, one's enough. Let's try that one first and see if we like it. God said, then God held the mountain over our heads and said, no, they come as a pair, accept them both or I drop the mountain. Right, so there is that. It's a midrash also. It's actually not from the straight text, but that's a midrash. But the midrash does speak to the fact that we didn't have a choice about the second part, about the oral law. But anybody who knows any Torah knows that you can't keep Torah without the oral explanations. It's not possible. Like, for instance, in the Torah, well, if you've seen a Torah scroll, right, there's no vowels in it at all. So just one small example is, first of all, just how do you vowel it? That's part of the oral tradition. So when it says, don't eat chet lamed vav with meat, is chet lamed vav, chet lamed bet, vet, is that chalev or chalav? Don't have meat with chalav, milk, or don't have meat with chalev, fat. Right? It makes a big difference. So we all agree that it's milk and meat that we don't have together, but that depends on the vowels. And the vowels depend on an oral tradition. You can't possibly keep the Torah without the oral tradition, even for the vowels, let alone everything else. You have to have both together. So God understood that. We didn't yet.
I accept the fact, I understand that we accepted the mitzvot at Sinai. Converts accepted it through the Midrash. You just said, but I don't know why we're going down this road, because all we're trying to figure out is something bad is happening to a particular person.
Right.
Why is it happening? We might have unknowingly violated
right.
the mitzvah.
Okay, so right. So unknowingly or done other things not incorrect or not growing to our potential. Right. So we were just talking about being forced. Are we forced into the whole system? We're not forced into the whole system. Might we be forced into growth? We might be forced into growth. So that would be the suffering. So I'll just give you an example where it can be positive if we're forced into growth sometimes, but it feels like it's forced. So I went to a performing arts high school. I took ballet almost every day. And there was a new girl in the ballet class one day. And the teacher was all over her. Stand up straight. Don't drop your arm like a chicken. Don't let your hand flap. You know, lower your shoulders. Tuck in your tush and pull up your chest. And, like, she just started crying. She was like, why are you making me do this? You're picking on me and picking on me and picking on me. It's not fair. She totally broke down in front of the class. So the ballet teacher said, don't you cry when I correct you. You cry when I stop correcting you. I'm only correcting you because I see potential. And when I see potential, I'll correct you. But if I don't think you can do it, I won't say anything. That's the day you should cry. So I remember that from my freshman year in high school. And it reminds me now that I know of the 23rd Psalm, where it says, Shiftecha umishantecha, heme yenachemuni, thy rod and thy staff both comfort me. So a shepherd has one stick, right? But it's a rod and a staff. So the staff helps him go up the hills. He leans on it. But the rod, that same stick, when he whaps the tush of some sheep to get them back into the fold, right? It hurts the sheep a little bit. He's whapping them, right? But it's only for their good. They need to be part of the flock. So really, so the rod you lean on and the staff you're hit by, but if you understand that both are given to you by a loving God, that God allows you to lean on him and sometimes will give you a little patch. Sometimes it feels big, but it's only because he loves you and sees potential in you that he's doing it. So then they can both serve as comforts. So that's what that suffering is the patch to get back into the fold. It could also be expiation patches, which is not this, but the patch to get back into the fold is a patch of loving kindness. Well, they're both patches of loving kindness, actually. But in this particular case, the patch to move is a loving patch. So Musser is also a pathway to growth. You don't have to have that way. You can use this way. Does that answer that, hopefully? Or, yeah, okay, good. Okay, so let's get to this next principle here, which is if you know it, you can't learn it. This is something that I try to teach my teens regularly and try to keep in mind myself. If you know it, you can't learn it. One time I was at a Shabbat Across America dinner. It was about 20 years ago. And before I knew half of what I know now, but anyway, I was seated at a table with a Russian family who told me they know everything about Shabbos, everything. Her father, her grandfather was a rabbi, and she knows everything about Shabbos. She just has one question, if she doesn't mind, if I don't mind, if she asks me one question. And the question is there a source? Is there a source in the Torah for Shabbos? I don't think so. I hope not. What is it? Okay, good. All right. All right. So she wanted to know, is there a source in the Torah for Shabbos? So all of you know, yes, there's a source in the Torah for Shabbos. It says it all over the place. Keep the Sabbath and make it holy. But she didn't know. So, but her, the way she asked the question made it so she couldn't learn any more than that one question because she knows everything. If you know everything, you can't learn anything. You have to not know to be able to ask a question. By definition, you have to not know. So you can see that in the bigger realm. Right? If you think you know all about computers, then you can't listen to a computer expert. He can't teach you anything. You have to go in there knowing that he knows more than you in order to ask a question and learn something. But the same thing is true for things you know. And this is where it gets in our way. Sometimes when we know something, we stop wondering about it because we know. And we think we really do know, or maybe even we do know. But once we know and file it, it goes into our hard drive and is no longer part of our random access memory. I don't know much about computers, but I'm just using terms that kind of work here. It gets buried deep inside us once we know. We file it in the deep file. But really, it needs to be, if we want to keep learning it or keep living it or keep processing it, it needs to be in the front of our brains instead of in the back. It can only stay in the front of our brains if we're still wondering, at least a little bit. Because if we totally know it, then it becomes part of our history. So that's an important concept. If you know it, you can't learn it. Which leads to clarification, not clarity. The way to learn is by being engaged in a process of constant clarification. We're headed towards clarity, but we actually don't want to ever achieve it. Because if we get to clarity, then we know it. And it gets filed. So what we want is to be constantly in the process of clarifying, a constant process of clarification, constantly working it over, thinking about it again. And there's techniques for doing that. But let's just move down for this next concept. So that concept brings us to this vocabulary word, zichuch harayon. So I'm sure you've heard in Hanukkah that we want to use shemen zayit zach, pure. Olive oil, right? Zach is pure or clear, like clarified wine or clarified oil. That kind of clarify, right, is what zach means. So this is the same root. So zichuch harayon is the clarifying of an idea, like you clarify butter or wine or oil. So purifying of it. So it means working it over. The way that you do it is to work it over and work it over and work it over and know that you don't know it fully. That you know something about it, so you can put it in a compartment of something that you know about, but not something that you know completely. And most of our knowledge has to stay, if we want it to really affect us, has to stay in this way. So we'll talk about an exercise for that, but maybe not this time, because we want to get to these last two vocabulary words. So in order for this to affect our rutzone, In order for knowledge to affect our Ratzon, we have to be in this clarifying process. Ratzon is will or desire. Desire is what moves us. There's no point in teaching somebody something that they don't want to know because they won't remember it. They don't care. Think about teaching teenagers about how to organize their rooms, right? Until it's their question, they're not going to, until they have the desire for Seder, until they have the desire for organization, your lessons are just like floating out the window. There's no point, right? There has to be Ratzon. Once they come to you at some point, if they ever do, or they'll pick up a self-help book, you know, how to declutter your life, right? Once they pick it up, it's their desire. And then the answers fill right in because it's their hole that they've finally recognized. I don't know how to do this. Please teach me. Then you can teach it. But if you tell a kid, don't get a credit card, don't rack up debt, don't get a credit card, don't rack up debt, until they get that credit card and they have more debt than they can pay and they're worried, then they can listen to the lesson. They can't hear it beforehand. They just can't. So you do have to have the desire to learn the concept. So, and the desire affects our ability to learn, and the way we learn affects our desire. It's a cycle. So how we learn affects what we want to learn. What we want to learn affects how we learn. How we learn it then will affect our desire, and it keeps going on. So the desire, in order for the desire to be affected, we have to be involved in this process of zichuch harayon. Bless you. But what we're trying to achieve then is a knowledge that's pashut. Pashut, what does that mean? Does anybody know? Pashut. Anybody? Simple. But it doesn't mean simple. And that's going to be next week's class. It does mean simple, but it doesn't mean simple. So pshat, when we learn Torah, we learn pshat. That's the first level. It has to just make sense. That's pshat level. So when you read, I don't know, and Abraham walked up the hill with Isaac, so you have to get, okay, there's a hill, there's a father, there's a son. What's the pshat meaning, right? That they're walking up the hill. Then you might move into drush. Walking up the hill means they're going up in spiritual levels, right? But you can't think about hill as meaning up in levels and that the two of them are taking a journey moving up until you get, they're on a physical hill. That's the pshat. The simple level is they're on dirt, it's going up, there's an angle, and they're walking together. But you can't get to the next level of their hearts are together, they're actually going up in spiritual levels until you have the first level of pshat. Right? So pshat means the simple meaning of it. It has to be simple. However, this pashut actually we're going to translate as real. Let's see if I could get to where he talks about this. Okay. So I'll read this out of the book. So this is on page 28, on the page where it says simple, not simplistic, the last page of the photocopies that I made for you. And if you'd like to read this during the week, which is not homework, completely optional, but I recommend it, it will help you with zichuch harayon. Because everything that you've heard tonight is ideas, but if you want to start working it over and thinking about it, then actually looking at this will help with that. And we'll talk about the specific tool next week. Okay, so the second to the last paragraph, the last full paragraph on the page. Okay, we find that Rav Yisrael, meaning Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Musar movement, stresses the importance of working with pashut, often translated as simple ideas. This is because such ideas generally lend themselves to the type of introspection that can truly affect us. However, there is more than this. It is essential to understand that on some level, all of Torah must become pashut to us. For the only language the nefesh, the soul, grasps is that is of pashut ideas. This nefesh is actually a lower level of the soul than neshama. The concept of pashutness does not refer to whether an idea is well known or easy to understand. For both new and difficult to understand ideas must become pashut. Nor does it reflect the intellectual clarity that one may have of a certain concept. Rather, it means the idea penetrates deeper than the intellect. It affects the nefesh. The types of questions we mentioned above are an example of beginning this process of making Torah pashut. In order for anything to have a real impact on us, even the most sophisticated idea must become pashut to us. It must be real to us. Thus, in Musar parlance, a more accurate translation of Pashut is not simple but real. The stress is on the quality of the idea, as we shall see. So that's what we're going to look at more deeply next week. Simple, not simplistic. How do we make things Pashut? How do we bring it into a place? How do we make an idea inside us that we feel a click? We feel like it's real. We can relate to it as a realness and at the same time know that we don't know it, so that we can continue clarifying it, and yet we have enough of a grasp to work the clarifying work on. Does that help at all? Okay, so that's the start. We want to learn an actual practical process of how to make Torah affect us in a deep way. So you can ask any questions you like, or we can meet again next week. Great, thanks.
Thank you.